Welcome to the Lady of Crime, a true crime podcast. My name is Leona. This is the story of the 1978 Holiday Inn grease fire. Jean Hankam was pondering if the trip to the States was worth it. She'd never gone before. The annual tour was organized by the Mary Morton Travel Company in Toronto and the Watertown, Ontario Travel Agency. It would be the sixth such trip. The trip was set to be a weekend of shopping in the States after the Thanksgiving holiday. Black Friday is the official start to the holiday shopping season that happens the day after the American Thanksgiving. The travel companies saw a way to make a bit of money while transporting Canadians to the States in order to take advantage of the holiday savings. The savings weren't too massive with the exchange rate. On most items, the savings were average, maybe even minimal, but the savings on alcohol made up for it. By Thursday, Jean and her friends still hadn't made up their minds. The Ladies Auxiliary of Hamilton had 15 women signed up to go on the tour. The women were excited about the shopping, socialization, and, most of all, a chance to see what the States were like. Vice President of the Auxiliary, Lloyd Shepherd, would say just that. A bunch of women figured they just wanted to see the other side of the border. Anne Hamilton was one of the women from the auxiliary that had signed up to go. She was ready for the shopping and socializing. The cost was unbeatable at $50 per person for transportation and lodging. A little more than 100 Canadians from Ontario, Hamilton, and Toronto areas would sign up to take the tour. By Thursday evening, Jean had decided to go along with her friend. She said, "What the heck? I've never done it before, and it would be nice to get away." The itinerary looked fun, and they could use the toys, clothes, and alcohol they were planning to buy for the upcoming holiday season. The cheaper items would be great gifts. The tour departed from Toronto aboard several buses headed to Erie, Pennsylvania, Toledo, Ohio, and Greece, New York. Three buses of excited tourists arrived in Greece, New York, Friday morning. Greece is a continuous suburb of Rochester, New York. The organizers had rooms booked at the Holiday Inn Northwest. 130 tourists would stay at the hotel. 88 had booked through Mary Morton and 42 had booked through the Watertown Travel Agency. There was a lounge and restaurant attached to the hotel, and the hotel was very close to the Longridge and Greasetown malls. Those factors made it the best choice for the tourists. There was a wedding party in the lounge that Friday night. The tourists had time to unwind from the ride and avoid the hectic early Black Friday shopping. Some still went shopping that day. That evening, lots of tourists joined several other hotel guests at the lounge for the party. "We had a ball," Anne would later say. Saturday was a real shopping day. Despite not getting the savings Americans got, the Canadian shoppers still shopped. A lot. The stores at the Longridge Mall were packed with holiday shoppers on Saturday, November 25, 1978. The Canadian shoppers brought clothes, shoes, toys, and alcohol from stores like Sears, McCurdy's, and JCPenney's. The stores boasted deep discounts to draw in shoppers, and they worked. The mall was crowded to near capacity. People fought crowds for the latest in everything from fashion to toys. The Speak and Spell and the Star Wars action figures were popular toys and games for young kids. Women searched for the perfect pair of thumbs-up jeans or a cape-collared dress or the new rave, the Simon game, an electronic color memory game for their older kids. The Longridge Mall had an amazing feature called the Electric Ball Circus. It was an enormous sculpture of colored balls of all sizes that traveled through wire loops, activated spinning chains, and set off hammers to ring bells. The Electric Ball Circus amazed all shoppers, tourists, and locals alike. A lot, if not all, of the tourists made a visit to the Greasetown Mall as well. The visit to the malls for the tourists lasted pretty much all day. The tourists would return to the hotel in the evening, heavily laden with shopping bags, ready to return home the next day. The hotel, too, was near capacity on Saturday night. Several guests from at least one off-site wedding and several people in town for the holiday, along with the Canadian shopping tour, nearly filled the hotel. The hotel's lounge held what was billed as a singles mingle on Saturday night. The singles dance brought several people from the area into the lounge and restaurant. A band was set up to play for the guests. The singles dance had gone long into the night. Guests from the singles dance, tourists, and other guests buzzed around the hotel late into the night. Music from the band flowed well after midnight. The party broke up somewhere around 1 in the morning. The band began to break down its gear between 12:30 and 1. One of the band members remembers being gone by 1:45 on Sunday, November 26, 1978. Band member Rick Teresi said, "I think we played until 1, which means we're pulling out of the rear parking lot between 1:40 and 1:45. This is because it took them between 30 and 40 minutes to pack up their gear." By 2 o'clock, the hotel was quiet. There were a few staff members still at the hotel. The innkeeper, Georgine Weinhardt, lived at the hotel. She was in her apartment on the second floor. The hotel's lobby and guest room area was an L-shaped building. The west wing was 3 floors tall. The north wing was 2 floors tall and it held the lobby. There were 91 guest rooms, a couple of conference rooms, and the innkeeper's apartment that had been converted from a few guest rooms. The carport and the front east of the building allowed entrance into the parking lot in the middle and on the back and sides of the building. Next to the hotel on the left or east side sat a lounge. It was a completely round, glass-front building that looked much like a carousel, and a restaurant that sat behind it. They were being tended to or cleaned by the other staff on duty that night. Peter Sullivan, the front desk clerk. Joanne Christensen, a backup bartender and waitress. Teresa or Terry Sissinger, a waitress. And Joseph Lang, the bartender. The pool behind the restaurant was empty and quiet, as one would expect at 2 a.m. From the east to west on Ridge Road, the lounge area is the first portion of the hotel that you see. The carport along the first wing becomes visible. Then the L forms where the internal doors and stairs allow you access between the two wings. And then the second or west wing becomes visible as you pass the rest of the building. The west wing is only visible to the side of Bridge Road as you pass east to west. Doors between the wings of the hotel were popped open at night. They are normally closed. It was bitter cold that early Sunday morning. The thermometer registered between 16 and 23 degrees. Snow had fallen, but by 2:15 a.m. the skies were clear. The only traffic that passed on the normally busy Route 104 or Ridge Road were people headed to or from work. At 2:30 a.m., an off-duty firefighter, Lieutenant Harold Bud Phillips, spotted flames on the far west corner of the building as he was driving east to west past the hotel on his way home from his second job as a security guard for Eastman Kodak Company. Phillips would pull into the parking lot and was said to have backed his car into a space. He entered the hotel and saw flames in a supply closet on the first floor. The flames were pretty much walking up the stairs towards the ceiling. Francis Fritz Neidhart of Albion, the former chief of the Albion Fire Department, also spotted flames from the building on his way past. He too was headed home from his job as foreman at Eastman Kodak. Phillips called in the fire at 2:38 a.m. on his two-way radio. "Send me a full assignment to the Holiday Inn. I've got a code 5 with people trapped." In those 8 minutes, the fire began to grow and quickly spread. Martha Talbert of Toronto awoke to what she described as crinkling noises in the wall. Some guests heard the fire alarm, but as it was not a large alarm system, most did not hear it. In most cases, if guests heard the alarm, they did not know what it was or what it meant. Gladys Taylor of Hamilton said people running down the hall woke her up. Gail Ross of Watertown said she heard just loud noises. Other guests say they were woken by people running down the hall or people partying in the neighboring rooms. However, soon everyone was aware that the building was on fire. As Gladys thought that people were partying and horsing around in the hallway, she then heard someone yell "fire." She, Jean Coffer, and Norma Bowden, touring with the ladies from the auxiliary, were on the first floor with several ladies from the Watertown tour group. They tried to escape by going out the door, but could not make it out. They opened the drapes of the window to a horrific sight. Mary Bowden said, "I opened the drapes and saw flames right beside us. It was blazing. I mean blazing." The ladies managed to escape the room into the parking lot. Several people came to shield them from the flaming building and the 16-degree New York weather. On the second floor, many guests had to jump to safety. Bernie Lerner awoke to someone banging on her door screaming, "Fire, get out!" To her horror, she opened the door to thick black smoke that quickly poured into the room. She slammed the door shut. "Mother, get up. Get dressed," she gasped. Her 64-year-old mother-in-law, Roberta, was in the room with her. The ladies quickly got dressed. They had to cover their mouths as they made it to the window. They used whatever they could find to cover their faces as they inched towards the window to safety. 31-year-old Bernie saved her mother-in-law's life that night, along with her own, as they jumped out of their second-story window. Bernie said, "We're jumping now. We're not waiting." Both ladies used their strength to break the window. Bernie jumped, telling Roberta to jump right behind her. Roberta jumped seconds after Bernie did. They landed, dazed, for a few moments, but were rescued quickly by firefighters and rushed to ambulances. Both women were taken to Packard Hospital in Greece. Both women survived. Bernie, with a few broken bones and several deep cuts on her hands and lots of scrapes and bruises all over. Roberta was a little more seriously injured, but would recover. Bernie would say, "I didn't smell anything and I didn't hear an alarm until the knock at the door." Jillian Slater and her mother, Olive, were on the second floor as well. The women were rescued from the hotel's second floor after Jillian smashed a chair through the window in the room she and her mother shared. Both women had been admitted to Rochester General Hospital for smoke inhalation. The women escaped the room in their nightgowns, leaving everything behind. Jillian said, "I'm just happy we got out, period," when asked about the things she and her mother had lost in the fire. Georgine Reinhardt was asleep in her apartment when the fire alarm woke her. She called the front desk, only to get a busy signal. As she hung up, the phone rang in her hand. It was Peter Sullivan, the front desk clerk. "Fire!" he yelled. Georgine said, "I know," and hung up. She made her way down the stairs to the main floor, where thick smoke made it very hard to see. She managed to make out Teresa, the waitress, and yelled to her, "Call the fire department." A few people in the lobby said the fire department had already been called. Georgine and other employees were hampered in their duty to perform the fire procedure of checking areas to ensure guests were getting out. Fear, fire, and smoke made the task near impossible. Georgine also had the added task of ensuring that her mother got out of the apartment they shared on the second floor. After she ensured that her mother was out, she went to check the areas she could before she finally had to escape. By that time, all around the hotel, people were escaping. Those who could make it out got out. The fire continued to rage onto the third floor. Tony Battali McIntyre and her new husband William recounted their harrowing escape from the back of the third floor on their wedding day. The Rochester natives hadn't had time to take off work for a proper honeymoon. The newlyweds didn't have a ton of money either. They booked the weekend in the bridal suite on the third floor of the Holiday Inn Northwest. They decided the close-to-home destination was best. 29-year-old Tony would say, "We didn't have time to take off work, so we thought we'd splurge on a nice suite for the night with no surprises." William said, "We were woken up by the alarm at 2:30. They got up and dressed quickly. By this time, the smoke was billowing up the stairs. William opened the door to the suite and smoke began to fill the room. The couple ran as fast as they could down the back stairs and out of the hotel. The fire would punch through the roof soon after and would collapse onto the top floors. All I could hear was people screaming, and all I could do was cry," Tony said. Lieutenant Harold Phillips was at that time a 10-year veteran of the Greece Fire Department. He moonlighted as a security guard to make ends meet. In 1978, the Greece Fire Department had 75 firefighters. 25 were paid and 45 were volunteers. Lieutenant Phillips, known as Bud, was a paid firefighter. Phillips said, "When I first went in, I thought it was a partition fire. Then all of a sudden, the fire took off," Phillips said as he described the scene. "People were hanging out of the windows, screaming to be saved." He said he saw a woman going headfirst out of a window and had to convince her to go back in and come out feet first. People were terrified as they attempted to save their lives. The scene was utter chaos. Firefighters from Greece Ridge Fire Department were the first on the scene, with a truck from the substation about 3 minutes from the hotel. Within 20 minutes, the Greece Ridge Fire Department, the North Greece Fire Department, the Barnard Fire Department, and the Rochester City Fire Department had responded to the hotel's call for help. Tom Knowles, a firefighter at Greece, told 16 by 9's Anthony Robart that when he pulled up, he could hear people screaming and windows breaking. Knowles was at home and heard the tone used by town officials to alert for emergencies. Police Chief Gerald Phelan was next to make his way to the fire. He said, "The sky was lit up." When he got to the building, he said it was pretty much engulfed in flames. Knowles was one of the first to enter the building and immediately began seeing victims. The fire was fast and hot. It made its way up the stairs, splitting to both wings of the hotel. Francis Neidhart had entered the building and was ushering people out any way they could find. "People were groping the walls trying to find an exit," he said. "I was grabbing them and pointing them toward the doors. Several people would make their way out this way." Neidhart said he'd heard the fire hissing and rolling between the ceiling and the roof in an attic-like passage. Now deceased Barnard firefighter Greg Perina said he was on the roof of the hotel with his team trying to, quote, vest out the smoke, when another firefighter suggested that they move off the roof as something didn't feel right. Greg would say, "No more than a minute after we climbed down, the fire broke through the roof, right where we were." Phillips was still in the building. He spent a good amount of time after calling in the fire helping people escape before the departments arrived. There was no control on the scene. People were inside escaping in any way they could. Fire and gas were breaking out windows trying to get oxygen to live. As fire crews arrived, Phillips turned from rescue to help to extinguish the fire. He recalled, "It was so hot on the third floor that the water had no effect. The fire rolled right at us." Firefighter Michael Zordecki said, "The fire was like a whirlwind roaring through the ceiling and floor as if it couldn't be stopped. The smoke was tremendous." Zordecki was injured fighting the fire. He spoke of the fire in awe from his hospital bed. Zordecki had injured his back as he caught a woman jumping from the second floor of the building. He was off duty that night but responded to the fire when he heard it call over the scanner. Zordecki would also say, "At one point, the fire was draping so low from the ceiling that they had to call men back." As the roof collapsed, more people were rescued. More people jumped or escaped the fire either on their own or with the help of firefighters, police, paramedics, and civilians who were drawn to the fire. Emergency crews treated the injured, laid out on the hoods of cars and the cold pavement of the hotel's parking lot. Kevin Neary, the cook from the Howard Johnson's restaurant, gave the clothes off of his back to assist survivors as they escaped. The restaurant became a haven to the survivors of the fire. The workers soon closed to the public so they could provide whatever the victims needed. Most of the people making their way to the restaurant were in their night clothes only, drenched in the smell of smoke, wet, cold, covered in ash and dirt. Neary said they didn't really want to eat. They just wanted water to wash the taste of smoke out of their mouths and coffee to stay warm. At around 2:30, Diane Sullivan, a waitress at the Howard Johnson, said, "I looked out and saw flames shooting out of the back of the hotel. She called the police immediately." The restaurant was in the Stone Ridge Plaza across the street from the hotel. The buildings faced each other. This timeline was released in the investigation report of the hotel fire prepared by David P. Demers, a fire analyst specialist for the Fire Investigations Department. At 2:30 a.m., the first indication of the fire alarm operating, the driver of a charter bus is awakened by a bell ringing and looks at his watch. 2:38 a.m., Grease Ridge Fire Department was notified by firefighter passing by. Another passerby stopped at the building to help and reports no fire alarm bells ringing. Grease Ridge Fire Department dispatches 4 engines, a ladder, a rescue, 6 on-duty personnel, and approximately 60 volunteer firefighters. 2:39 a.m., west section of the building heavily involved with fire. 2:43 a.m., 2 additional ladder trucks requested to the scene. 2:43 a.m. again, Grease volunteer ambulance dispatches 2 ambulances. 2:44 a.m., ambulances from Barnard and Lakeshore are dispatched. 2:45 a.m., most clocks and buildings stop. 2:46 a.m., Barnard rescue requested at the scene. 2:46 a.m. again, Grease Ridge Fire Chief requests 3 engines to the scene. 2:52 a.m., Grease Ridge Deputy Chief requests 2 buses to the scene to keep hotel evacuees warm. 2:53 a.m., self-contained breathing apparatus cylinders requested. 2:55 a.m., North Grease pumpers appear to the scene. 3:23 a.m., additional ladder truck requested at the scene. 3:26 a.m., additional pumper requested at the scene. 3:55 a.m., additional pumper requested at the scene. 4:43 a.m. Grease Ridge Fire Chief reports the fire under control. The fire burned for 2 hours before it was under control and completely out. The headcount began. They knew they had some fatalities as firefighters had already come across dead bodies. Lieutenant Phillips called a woman he saw trying to escape. I saw her struggling to get the window open. We found her dead on the floor. Need Hurt said, I thought we'd save those people when he saw the sheets being drawn over the body of a woman and others that had been brought out of the hotel. 10 people would lose their lives in the fire, 7 of the Canadian tourists and 3 American visitors. 42-year-old Joyce Alpeter Plum of Arlington, Virginia, is believed to be the woman Lieutenant Phillips found after she was unable to open her window. She had been in town for her high school reunion at John Marshall High School in Rochester, New York. She died of smoke inhalation. 26-year-old Nancy Garrett of Pompano Beach, Florida, was in town with her father for a holiday visit with friends. Her father would identify her body as she had been found dead of smoke inhalation. 29-year-old Stephen Gregory Ford of Ypsilanti, Michigan, was in town for his best friend's wedding. He was found in his hotel room. He had succumbed to smoke inhalation, and some reports say he was then burned beyond recognition. He was said to be identified with dental records. 81-year-old Rubina Ruth Cushnan of Toronto, Ontario, and her daughter, 61-year-old Ruby Cushnan of North York, Ontario, were found in their hotel room dead of smoke inhalation. Husband and wife, 67-year-old Edward Francis Farley and 62-year-old Lorraine Jane Farley of Etobicoke, Ontario, along with 57-year-old Marguerite Viola Duncan of Etobicoke, and her family members, 30-year-old Pamela Sandu of Toronto and 33-year-old Huguette Sandu of Bramalia, Ontario, were found in a stairwell doorway. Evidence shows that Mr. Farley was leading the ladies out when he fell at the doorway and the ladies fell behind and on top of him. All 5 died of smoke inhalation. Shortly after the fire was under control, the surviving guests, able to escape uninjured, were transferred to the Genesee Plaza Holiday Inn on Main Street in Rochester. Luggage that was stacked in the hotel lobby was soon transported to the town hall. By late that evening, the guests claimed their belongings and boarded buses home. Arrangements had to be made for the Hamilton tourists as their bus had been destroyed in the fire. 34 people were injured in the fire, including firefighters. All would recover. After the bodies of the dead had been recovered, it took a bit of investigation work to identify them, as they were all dressed for bed and not carrying any forms of identification. Chief Palin said, after a bit of difficulty identifying the dead bodies found in robes and nightgowns, I believe all the hotel guests are accounted for. The 6th annual tour would be the last at the Holiday Inn Northwest. Several guests had made the trip each year, including a few who died. Mary Morton cried as she spoke with the guests, I don't think they'll all be coming home this time. Brian Sundu spoke with Anthony Robart about the death of his mother, Huguette. That Sunday afternoon, he, his father, and sisters were getting ready to go get their mother from Toronto. They were headed to meet the bus on return from the shopping tour. Just before they left, the phone rang. Mr. Sundu answered the phone to the call that would change his life forever. He took his son into his bedroom and told him that his mother, grandmother, and aunt would not be coming home. He explained to Brian that the women had all died in a fire at the hotel they were staying in. It was devastating, he said. It was like a bomb went off in my world. Brian remembers he and his father cried for some time before his father could get enough composure to tell his daughters that their mother was dead. Stephanie was 5 at the time and had lost her first tooth. She was so excited to show her mother that first tooth. Instead, she ended up placing that tooth in the coffin with her mother. Tracy, who was 9 when her mother died, spoke to me about the gifts that they had gotten. The authorities had shipped the items Huguette had purchased as they were safe in the bus and not in the fire. Tracy said of the items, I hated them. I simply couldn't look at them. I simply wanted my mother. Daybreak brought lots of questions. Where did the fire start? Why did 8 minutes pass before the fire was finally called in? If the waitress across the street called at 2:30 a.m., why didn't the fire get responded to sooner? Was the fire alarm inadequate? The fire alarm was a target of the initial investigation. The fire alarm system was made up of those red pull boxes at the end of each hallway. Each floor had a bell that was triggered by a pull at the box. Only a few of the residents heard the alarm. Some who heard the alarm didn't realize it was a fire alarm. Mary Buffer of Toronto said she did hear an alarm, but only after the noise in the hallway woke her up. In fact, only 5 of the 18 guests interviewed for a Times Union story said they heard an alarm. Mary said, "It sounded like a smoke alarm at home, not a loud bell." The rooms did not have smoke detectors. The hotel's alarm had one alarm box per floor. The alarm box on the wall near the five victims found in the stairwell had been pulled, as well as the one on the third floor. The alarm system worked on a battery that was tested and found to be in working order. The alarm could have been turned off at the hotel's front desk, but it's clear that it had been on and worked to the capacity it could. According to the official investigation report by David P. Demers of the National Fire Protection Association, guest notification was haphazard, and the fire department was only alerted when Lieutenant Phillips called it in, as the alarm was not hooked up to the fire department for immediate notification. The connection of the alarm to the fire station was not a requirement, and the hotel chain had no plans to change it. Civilians who entered the hotel to help, as well as initial responders, did not hear the fire alarm. The hotel had no sprinkler system. The day's light brought into view the horror experienced by those in the hotel that early morning as the fire raged. The marquee still advertised the singles dance. Gaping, charred holes replaced the stone and wood front of the hotel. The parking lot was littered with mattresses, lamps, chairs, and other things thrown out in bids to escape. The plants still hung from the ceiling, visible through busted out windows. As firefighters made their way through the hotel, they saw the hallways littered with personal belongings like shoes, toothbrushes, and glasses. They found curtains and sheets tied to things and flung out of windows used to escape. They found most rooms as escaping guests had left them. In one room, a Bible was left on the nightstand open to the Psalms. In another room, abandoned meals from Kentucky Fried Chicken, now known as KFC, and pizza boxes were sprawled, along with cold coffee and diluted cocktails. Other rooms held the packages of guests who did not store their goods on the buses. Soaking wet, in some cases charred, and smoke-filled, brightly wrapped packages were piled in corners, stored either way until the trip home. Luggage packed for the trip home was being neatly stacked in the lobby. The cleanup began as a necessity to find the origin of the fire. The lounge and restaurant had little more than smoke damage, but both wings of the hotel had been completely destroyed, with the roof collapsing on both the north and west wing. Of course, the investigation also focused on the point of origin and the cause of the fire. And after investigators started talking to the responders, they also tried to figure out why the fire had moved so fast. The hotel was built in 1963 by construction companies owned by Anthony J. Comparto and Leo F. Spiazzo. It was located at 1525 Westridge Road in the town of Greece. The structure cost $1.3 million to build. Originally built as the Six Scraps Restaurant and Motor Inn, the L-shaped building held 100 guest rooms along with a cocktail lounge and restaurant. The builders ended their relationship with the Motor Inn in early 1966. The coach and restaurant and motor inn would operate for just under a year before the builders sold the building. The new owners would sign a 20-year lease with a Holiday Inn subsidiary. In July 1967, the hotel would begin to operate as the Holiday Inn Northwest. In 1972, the hotel was redecorated, including new furniture, new carpeting, and an innkeeper's apartment. The building was built of masonry concrete and had a combustible roof. The walls were concrete slabs spaced with brick on the exterior. The interior portions of the walls were 4-inch thick masonry concrete with 2 coats of plaster. In the beginning, Lieutenant Phillips thought there was just a partition fire in one of those partitions. The interior walls did not go all the way up to the roof. The walls stopped where the roof trusses began. This left an open alley between the ceiling and the roof. The floor and ceiling were a system called dox plank, large precast slab. The ceilings had also been covered in an additional ceiling of suspended acoustical tiles. Each hotel room and hallway was not only plastered, but had the additional acoustical tile ceiling. The investigation could not determine whether the ceiling tiles were fire-rated or if they met any fire standard for building. The roof was wooden trusses with metal gussets. The trusses made up a pitched roof, sheathed in particle board and plywood, then topped with felt waterproofing and asphalt. There was a small bit of dock plank ceiling on the roof on the north end that was dotted with holes for wiring purposes. That portion of the dock plank roof was held up by a steel beam. Doors, called fire doors, were on each floor of the hotel in both wings. The doors opened to stairwells that allowed access to the other floors. The doors on the first and second floor were propped open by kick-down stands attached at the bottom of each door. A small passageway at the bottom floor connected the wings. The passageway led to a central stairway. Right underneath the stairs on the first floor of the west wing was a supply closet. That supply closet was determined to be the point of origin. As the fire investigation kicked off, local fire investigators were leaning towards an accidental fire. They had preemptively determined that the building itself caused the fire to move so fast and burn so hot. Investigators suspected that the fire started with combustible materials in or near the closet that ignited the lightweight paneling and adhesive used to attach the paneling. The doors propped open allowed oxygen to allow the fire to build and climb up the steps. The hotel had been inspected for fire safety on November 8, 1978 by Lieutenant Phillips. We found only minor violations, nothing that would go past our yearly inspection. A fire inspection report reflected those sentiments. However, a second report was found with just one amendment. A new sentence had been added saying, "Inspectors suggested that the hotel connect the alarm system to the fire department." New Police Chief Todd Baxter stated, "Two reports are suspicious." The Assistant District Attorney, Joel Crane, said the fire inspector missed several violations. The ADA said he was normally exact in these things when speaking of Lieutenant Phillips missing some of those violations. Reports say the hotel had been warned at least twice by the Grease Fire Department, that the hotel had been advised to upgrade the fire procedure. The fire department suggested that the hotel do so. It was not a requirement. Some of the materials or building practices used in the original building of the hotel no longer comply with the new safety rules. Again, there were no requirements to update. Investigators would later say some of those materials and practices could have led to the fire size. The original investigators had not ruled out arson or accident, but they had ruled out natural causes. Grease Chief Police Phelan thought the fire deserved a closer look. On the 27th, the chief called on arson expert John Stickeivers from New York City to examine the scene. Stickeivers was amazed that a cause had been preemptively determined before most of the water and debris had been removed from the building. He said, "When I cleared everything out, I determined that a flammable liquid had been poured in the stairwell area in front of and into the closet." Stickeivers had found that the aluminum kick plates at the bottom of the doors closest to the fire had melted to liquid and flowed across the floor. This meant that the fire had generated heat at least in the area of about 1200 degrees. This is a whopping 800 degrees hotter than a normal fire at that ground level. That's a fire that has not been accelerated. This indeed was an arson fire, no accident at all. Chief Palin said in a press conference, quote, "This was a set fire," end quote. The original investigators had spoken too soon, according to Stickeivers. They had made presumptions before the floor was clear of debris and water and were unable to see burn patterns in the floor. The whole area was tested for chemical type. Items in the closet were determined to be non-combustible cleaning materials. The chemical found poured on the floor and in the closet as the accelerant was MEK, methyl ethyl ketone. As December came, the case was in the early stages of a suspect hunt. There had been other fires in the area that could have been or were determined to be arson. At least 10 fires had been reported in the weeks before the Holly Inn fire. Deliberate fires had been set in basements or storage areas of buildings in the area. Most of the fires were set in apartment buildings. No suspects were developed. Police and fire investigators didn't know whether the fires were the work of one or more arsonists. Chief Palin and investigators had determined that the fire at the Holly Inn was not the work of the arsonist studying the other fires in or around the Grease, New York area. The cases were investigated separately. In 1979, a fire was set in the Holly Inn in Cambridge, Ohio. The Holly Inn fire in Cambridge also killed 10 people. A suspect would later be arrested for a fire near Buffalo, New York. That suspect would be cleared of both Holiday Inn fires, and the fires at the Holiday Inns were determined not to be connected. Early on, and still to this day, several people, including Chief Palin, investigator Stickavers, and tons of other people in the town suspect one person in the fire. The investigators believe that the then lieutenant and now retired Grease Fire Chief Harold Bud Phillips set the fire. Phillips has denied that accusation from the beginning. ADA Joel Crane said he was told by police that Phillips said he was going to start a small fire and be around and be the first person there to put it out to show that the safety issues contributed to the fire. ADA Crane also said while the polygraph test was not reliable, Phillips did not pass his. In a newspaper story written for the Democrat and Chronicle on November 27, staff writer Dan Lovely quoted Phillips as reflecting on the reason he became a firefighter. "I wanted to do something different than work for Kodak. I wanted excitement. I wanted to prove to everyone that you don't have to go to college to get a decent job." When approached by Anthony Robart on 16x9, Phillips again denied that he started the fire. Phillips also said that the department did not agree with the arson findings. The case was all but dormant for years. A secret investigation had gone on since 2011, and in 2015, then Chief of Police Todd Baxter submitted a finalized report to DA Sandra Dorley. In that report, a suspect was named. Dorley did not act on the report. In fact, to this day, DA Dorley says she cannot move on that report and a suspect because there could be other suspects, and in her mind, based on the reports that say the fire could have been an accident, there are questions to the validity of the findings of arson, she wouldn't feel comfortable moving forward. DA Dorley said she will most likely never move to the grand jury, as too many what-ifs exist. "I want to be sure, and with this case, I am not sure," Dorley said. No one has been charged. Many say they think there is someone out there with a missing piece that will close the case. Tracy Sundew said, "I don't think we are going to get an answer." The Facebook group Holiday Inn Fire Truth has many members who believe a conspiracy has kept the investigation from moving forward. Police deny this claim. The group's members would like a special prosecutor to do an independent investigation. This has been the story of the 1978 Holiday Inn Fire. There are several links on the website that you guys can follow in reference to recent stories about the case. Thank you for listening. Bye. Thank you for listening to the Lady of Crime True Crime Podcast. If you'd like to leave me a suggestion, you can drop me an email at theladyofcrimepodcast@gmail.com or theladyofcrimepodcast.com. Thank you.